Hey, Postmortem fans, producer Joe Russo here. Last month, one of Mick's most beloved creative endeavors celebrated its 15th anniversary, and we wanted to do something special to commemorate it. When I attended the International Horror and Sci-Fi Film Festival in Tempe, Arizona in 2005, I caught my first episode of Masters of Horror, Dance of the Dead, directed by the late, great Tobe Hooper, who I had the chance to meet after the screening. What I didn't know at the time was the show's creator, Mick Garris, was showcasing Masters of Horror at film festivals and genre conventions around the world, building the hype for this once-in-a-lifetime collaboration between horror legends, and rightfully so. Masters of Horror lived up to its name, not just in premise, but in execution. The Showtime series allowed Mick to curate stories from some of his favorite filmmakers working in the genre, giving them the opportunity to tell their stories the way they wanted to tell them, free from notes and creative interference. Because of that, many of these legends delivered some of their best work in recent memory, and we, the viewers, reaped the rewards. And the legacy of Masters of Horror continues to this day. In 2005, Mick brought the dark genre of horror to television uncut and unfettered, paving the way for it to grow, flourish, and mature. Without Masters of Horror, who knows how long it would have been before we saw the likes of beloved television series as macabre and scary as American Horror Story, The Walking Dead, or The Haunting of Hill House. And, on a more personal note, without Masters of Horror, I certainly wouldn't have had the chance to help Mick produce its spiritual successor, the critically acclaimed Nightmare Cinema. While the history and fate of Masters of Horror has been well documented on this podcast in past AMAs, to celebrate its anniversary, we thought you should hear it from the masters themselves. This series was born out of the renowned Masters of Horror dinners Mick put together. These special gatherings let some of horror's greatest luminaries break bread, commiserate, and talk shop, and, having been to the last in-person gathering before the pandemic myself, I can confirm they're as amazing as you've imagined. That's why we recorded the audio from last month's digital Masters dinner at Nightstream, where Mick was awarded the Overlook Film Festival's Masters of Horror Lifetime Achievement Award, so we could give our listeners a peek behind the curtain of these special nights. Not only will you get to hear about the experience of making Masters of Horror from some of the directors who helped bring Mick's seminal series to life, but you'll get to hear what their relationship with Mick means to them. So, without further ado, here's John Carpenter, Joe Dante, Mike Flanagan, John Landis, Axel Carolyn, Ernest Dickerson, Bill Malone, Tommy McLaughlin, and Tom Holland, all celebrating Masters of Horror, and, even more importantly, our host, Mick Garris.
We will have a couple more folks joining in just a bit, but all of you are, of course, here for somebody whose career spans from Amazing Stories to Critters 2 to Psycho 4 to Sleepwalkers, Riding the Bullet, an incredible collection of stories, including his latest novel, These Evil Things We Do, and a person who has been so generous of his time to the filmmakers, the horror community, and to festival programmers everywhere. We've had the great honor of having him present this award to many others, and it is long overdue that we gave it to him. Again, as said, nobody embodies the community and championing of this genre more so than this man. It is our great, great privilege to present him with our Master of Horror Award, Mr. Mick Garris, everyone. There he is.
Thank you so much. Thank you to all of you. And thank you so much for showing up at this humble gathering here. All of my friends whose shadows I stand beneath. And thank you for being here. And thank you, Landon.
Thank you, Mick. Now, before we go any further, it is our honor to give you this great, great award. I've got it just off screen here. So let me just get it and please take it.
Wow.
Now, look at that.
Isn't that awesome?
The miracle of Zoom.
I was so lucky to give one to Roger Corman and one to Stuart Gordon, and I coveted it. And now I have my own, and it's... It's pretty
amazing. Wow.
And it's really heavy, and it can probably be good for shaving too.
And you don't have to take it on the airplane when you go back to home.
Like you did, Joe.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, that would be tough to check through customs or anything. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here. This is really an honor, and it's one of my favorite festivals in the world. And it means a lot. And it's not like any of the other festivals. And to just be a part of it for several years has been fantastic. And to be a recipient is even more so.
Well deserved. Well deserved.
Yes, sir.
Congratulations. Well,
in order to congratulate you, we'll let our guests do that one by one and say a few words in your honor, because you don't get off that easy with just an award. Everybody here would like to toast you. So let us please start with Mr. Joe Dante.
Well, I knew Mick when he was a lowly publicist. And but I don't use the word lowly lightly, because he wasn't just a publicist. He was a fan. And everything that he was working on, and this was like, I think 1980 or so, he was a fan, and he loved this stuff. And it was with incredible enthusiasm that he would set up all of this publicity for these various pictures. And when he was working at AFCO Embassy, he was the publicist on The Howling, and was so enthusiastic and so helpful. And, you know, to me, he was like just, it was this other kid who is a kid to me, because he was a lot younger than me and somehow still is. Over the years, we became friends. And I did an episode of Amazing Stories, Mick had written the script for the episode I did. And which was a very odd episode, which I won't go into. But over the years, I think aside from just being a friend and being a movie fan and being very talented, his entrepreneurship has been amazing to me. I mean, Mick created out of whole cloth the whole Masters of Horror concept. I mean, first he initiated the dinners, which everybody, you know, whenever there was enough people in town who liked making these kind of films, would be together. He would, you know, we'd go to some restaurant and we'd all be there and we'd grouse about how badly the industry was treating us. And we all got to know each other. We got people that we wouldn't ordinarily have run into, because in the film business, you know, you don't ordinarily run into other people because you're on your set, you're doing your stuff. You can't make friends that easily because you're so busy. But Mick put all these people together, and many of them became very friendly. And when it finally came time for him to realize his dream, which was, I want to put together a series where all these guys will get to do films in a series. I think he originally thought of it as a theatrical series, but then it ended up being a cable series, which ran for two seasons. And everybody got to do essentially whatever they wanted to do. There were no strictures. There was no, I mean, Showtime said no male nudity, you know, and some stuff like that. But basically, you could choose whatever you wanted. And I got to do some far out political stuff that I couldn't have done for anybody else. And so Mick became an aggregator. I mean, he was sort of a mini Roger Corman in the way that he sort of put together a whole lot of people who could, you know, had an aegis to do stuff. And that was in addition to the fact that he was also writing, he was also directing. I think the picture he wrote, Hocus Pocus, was like number two or number one 2 weeks ago in the COVID era movie list of what's making money. And, you know, he's never, and plus he's a novelist. I mean, the guy he's like a quadruple threat. And plus he's got a really cute wife. So, you know, I mean, he's one of my best friends, and I have always valued all the stuff he's added to my life and the opportunities he's given me. And I think he has a lot of people who can say the same thing about him.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Axel.
Yay. Well, congratulations, Mick, first of all.
Thank you.
I've known Mick since 2004, I think, quite a long time. And while the majority of the people here have known him as, like Joe mentioned, as a fan or a publicist who has built up his career to being a filmmaker, I've known him being on the other side, where I've met Mick when he was an accomplished filmmaker. And I was a reporter for Fangoria, and I was just eager to know everything about filmmaking and about the industry. And Mick has always been incredibly generous with his time and with his friendship, and has taken a lot of time, like, just telling me about what the business is like and what the industry is like and what filmmaking is like, and giving me kind of a sense of the reality of the life of a filmmaker. He's always been incredibly passionate about things and very keen to pass on the wisdom about everything, and watching every horror movie that comes out and commenting on every horror movie that comes out, which always leads to great debates. We've even been on the juries of some festivals where we got to discuss some films and generally agree, but sometimes absolutely not, which was really fun. And so we've had long conversations about the industry over the years, like first when I lived in London, it was through emails. And then I moved to Los Angeles and I got to meet Cynthia and have lunch with Cynthia and Mick, and then go have big hikes where we would talk about, you know, the latest film that or project that Mick was working on. And then I would tell him about the things that I was trying to put together. And he was one of the very first people to watch my first feature, Soulmate. And I still remember getting the phone call from Mick and Cynthia, and that movie was made for nothing. And he was incredibly encouraging and supportive. And I remember you said, Mick, that this was a mature work that was not the work of someone who always wears skulls and monsters. So obviously I'm still wearing monster t-shirts all the time. Yeah, and then over the years after that, I've had the chance of having Mick do a cameo in the next movie I made, Tales of Halloween, and then now he has another cameo in the movie I have coming up soon. But the most important thing that I've learned from Mick, I think, is that, you know, it's a difficult industry and there's ups and downs and there's peaks and valleys, and there's, you just have to have that overwhelming passion and that overwhelming drive to keep you going. And Mick has never lost that. And he's gone through all of it. He's done TV, he's done film, he's done big budget, he's done smaller budget, he's done everything. And his passion and enthusiasm for the genre is still the same, and for filmmaking. And he's still, there's nothing he likes more than creating things and watching things and discussing things. And he lives for horror. And it's just so incredibly encouraging to see someone who can, you know, get through their whole life being driven by that passion. And that's the thing that I hope I never lose, and that I've learned from you, Mick, and that I am incredibly thankful for. So congratulations.
Thank you, Ax.
Here's to you.
Thanks.
Stopping by now for dinner, a new guest. I hope he is ready to speak because he is already on camera. Mr. John Carpenter, everybody.
Hey there. Can you see me and hear me? Yes. I have a toast to you, Nick. Mick, I have a toast to you. Look at that hair. Lord God. Here's to you.
Thank you, Maestro.
No, well, hang on. You're a director, writer, author. You are the father of the Masters of Horror, a producer, and you are the kindest man in the horror business. I want to say thank you for all the years we've known each other. Thank you for everything you've done. And thank you for being a friend to Axel. No, I'm kidding. To you, Nick.
John, that means so much. Thank you. And thank you for showing up. Cheers.
My God, there's Landis. I can't believe it. Wow.
Nice to see you too, John.
And we've got John Landis has just joined as well. So would you actually like to go next, or do you want to wait a beat to toast Mick?
I'll go next.
After a beard stroke, yeah.
Get it over with. Mick, cut your hair. No, Mick. Hi, Bill. How come I can't see all of them at once?
Well, put Technology. It on gallery view, you will.
How do I do that?
Upper Don't right corner.
Upper
right corner.
Oh, brilliant. There you go. Hi, Joe. Who else is here? Hi, Ernest.
Hey.
Who else is here? Hi, strange man in the corner. Tommy.
Yeah, hello, hello.
Mike Flanagan. Do we know each other?
We do not, but I'm a huge fan. This room is populated with my idols.
Tom in the corner. Tom, are you awake?
Hey, John.
Me? No, yeah. Tom
McLaughlin. And you got Bill Malone and Axel.
Axel, I saw. She's the attractive one. All right. Mick, I raise my tiki cup to you. I met Mick Garris in the motel across the street from Universal Studios, which doesn't sound as sleazy, or it sounds as sleazy, but it's not as sleazy as it sounds. There was an old motel right across the street from Universal that they used to give unimportant people offices. And I was in pre-production on Animal House, and down the hall was the publicity office for Star Wars, which I don't think it had come out yet. Yes.
It had come out. Yeah.
Had come out.
Just come out. Yeah.
And there was a guy down there named Mick Garris, whose jobs were, I remember he did the remote controls on R2-D2 at Grauman's Chinese Theater for something. What was that? I forgot.
The Oscars. Yeah.
The Oscars. Okay. At, well, the Oscars at Grauman's?
No, no. It was at the Oscars in 1978. I didn't do the Grauman's thing, but I did other appearances.
Whatever. I knew him. He was a publicity guy and very knowledgeable and very nice and very ambitious. And he went on to become, I guess, a unit publicist, right?
Yeah.
You were on a bunch of movies.
Yeah, I started on Halloween, too. Yeah, I did. I did The Howling, and I did Escape from New York, and I did Scanners, and I did An American Werewolf in London, but not Unit.
Wow.
So he could only work for people I knew. No, but anyway, so I've known Mick a long time, and I got him a job to direct something at Disney called
Fuzzbucket.
What? Fuzzbucket. And I swore on my honor as a human and an American to Jeff Katzenberg that Mick Garris was one of the best directors I had ever met. I don't think you directed anything yet, had you? No, but I swore it, and they gave him the job, and I fucked off to Europe to make a movie. But in the meantime, he's gone on to amazing success. He's always been, as Mr. Carpenter said, a very sweet, warm guy, generous and ambitious and talented and works hard. And he always had long hair. It just wasn't always white. So Mick, Horror's Rolodex, this is to you. Long may you wave.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Mike Flanagan, would you like to go next?
Oh, good.
Certainly. Wow. Well, Mick, I first became familiar with Mick Garris's work when I was 16 years old, and I watched The Stand hanging on every single episode, and I had never seen anything like it. It was truly epic in a way I didn't know the genre was capable of. And I think as I continued to dive into the genre and learn more about horror and experience your work over the years, it really reinforced to me why Stephen King has trusted you with so many of his adaptations. And that's because you approach your filmmaking the same way you approach the world, which is full of empathy and kindness. Now, aside from your contributions as an artist, which are legion and which I'm sure we're all going to celebrate in greater detail tonight, your contributions to the horror community, which everyone has touched on, I think is an amazing thing. And that is because you seem to take authentic joy in building a big bonfire and inviting other storytellers to sit around it with you and just passing the flashlight to each one of them and asking them to tell a story. And that's a beautiful thing. That comes from a pure love of storytellers and storytelling. And the result of that is that you've built these bonfires on television. You've built them in the cinemas. You've built them out in the world at these incredible dinners that I've never actually attended. This is my first Masters of Horror dinner is here in this Zoom. And like I said earlier, it's populated by my idols and by the people who taught me to love horror as I came up in this industry.
Welcome, Mike. Welcome.
Oh my God. Yeah. it's an honor to call you a friend. I've enjoyed every one of our interactions over the years. You know, Mick was one of the very first human beings to see a film that I made off of Stephen King's Gerald's Game years back. He's one of the very first people I showed the film to. And it was a private screening, and I was terrified the whole time of what
Gerald's Game.
Yeah.
That was yeah. good.
Oh, yeah. thank you. I'm going to freak out. You guys are completely freaking me out. This is amazing. But I think one of the things that I find most amazing about you, Mick, is that when you assemble all of these storytellers and when you share your love of movies with them, you bring them together, not in a sense of competition, but as a chorus of people who love the genre. And I think the industry is better and we are all better because you do that, because you are who you are. So thank you for letting me be part of this tribute to you. It is so well deserved.
Thank you, Mike. And you know, I always wanted to make Gerald's Game, but when I saw you were doing it and when I saw the final product, I knew it was in the right hands. So thank you, my brother in King.
Cheers. To Mick.
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 It's the drinking game tonight.
It sure is. And now, of course, Ernest Dickerson.
Wow. Hey. I first met Mick at Dave's Laser, the long gone Dave's Laser on Ventura Boulevard. Always used to go in there to see what the new laser disc coming out was. And you know, we would bump into each other and we just, you know, talk. And it was always like really cool, but he paid me the ultimate honor by offering me an episode of Masters of Horror and actually a script that he wrote. And I got to tell you, it was the best director-producer relationship I ever had. He was totally there, totally supportive, you know, listening to everything, all the problems that we had. And you know, he ran, you know, he protected us from the network. And so, you know, that was Mick as producer. But over the years, he's become a really, really, really good friend. Somebody that I love seeing all the time and don't see often enough, but hey, this is the world we're in right now. But you know, it was good to, Mick allowed me to become part of the Brotherhood of the Masters. And I had a chance to meet a lot of my heroes, a lot of people that I grew up watching their work who influenced everything that I did. And to be part of that Brotherhood was is an honor. And so, Mick, thank you for your friendship. Thank you for everything you've done. I look forward to what you're going to do next.
Thank you so much, Ernest. Drinking time.
I'm starting to think that the vodka I put in this was a mistake.
Well, we have another 10 guests after these.
That's never a mistake.
One sip for every guest.
On that note, Tom Holland.
Oh, gosh. I was sitting here. The first time I met Mick was on Amazing Stories. And it was my first directing job after Fright Night. And I think you were still the publicist, Mick, right?
Well, no, I was the story editor on Amazing Stories. I had gotten out of that game by then.
Story editor. And what he did was I was... I was like a number one fan, like maybe Mike Flanagan is. But you took me in and you introduced me to Richard Matheson. And I went, my mind blanked. I didn't know what to say because he was like a hero of mine. And I was like, oh my goodness. So that was the first time I met you, but I knew you or knew about you because I'd seen interviews you'd done with people like John Landis. I don't know where I see him on cable TV.
On the Z Channel. That was my first.
That was it. Which was like the first time that people like me could get you could get film, you could watch, you could get things. That's right. And you were all my heroes, like John Landis. Hello, John.
Hello, John.
Then you had the perspicacity to cast me in The Stand, which I much appreciated, added to my SAG pension of almost nothing.
Tom, you saved the picture.
Where are you? Who said it? John, what? I
said you were the best thing in The Stand.
No, thank you very much.
Except I think it's a toss-up between you and John Landis, who's also the young rabbinical student in The Stand.
I'm the young rabbinical student in the desert, standing guard for, what was his name? The bad guy.
Randall Flagg.
Yes. Were you out there too at that air cemetery?
No.
It's a different location.
Different death.
Okay. But what you really did is what Joe mentioned to begin with. What Mick did was he brought together all of us, all the genre directors. And I felt I knew everybody in the business because of my work and from commercials on. I knew composers, cinematographers, you know, crew people, all that. I didn't, and writers, but I didn't know other directors and I didn't know other horror directors. And Mick, you brought us together, but you also introduced me to some of my heroes. You know, like, people we've lost. But anyway, that was a huge thing, to be able to have the camaraderie and share stories and feel like you weren't alone. There was support. I knew what other people were talking about when they talked about their travails. You know, one of the most amazing things I ever saw, which was John Landis playing the trivia game with
Quentin.
Pulp Fiction.
Quentin Tarantino. You know?
Yeah, it was amazing, but it was that. And then even better, it turned into a job, Mick. So thank you very, very much. My toast to you.
Thank you, in every way.
Thanks so much,
Tom.
Carpenter fucked off, didn't he? He's gone.
He was only able to be here a couple of minutes.
I'm sorry.
You know how he is.
But he showed up.
Who is here is Tommy McLaughlin.
Well, God, how can I begin? I have known Mick since 82, 83, and at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror. And I was at USC, I think, where the screening was. They bounced around so many times over the years. But he came up and he couldn't have been more gracious and complimentary, and we exchanged phone numbers and kind of just became friends. My wife at the time and Cynthia and him and I went all everywhere, you know, dinners, and I think we took a train to San Diego once, and we just, you know, hung out and expressed to one another how much we loved the genre and what we had, you know, were planning to do. And then I guess it was in 85 that you got Amazing Stories, and you were amazing to me because you asked me to, you know, co-write Head of the Class with you. And that was a, you know, major thing for me to actually work on something that, you know, Spielberg had created. And then it went on where you brought me in on Furs, you brought me in on The Others, brought me in on She-Wolf of London. I mean, it's like, you know, half of my career is thanks to Mick Garris. So I think the only thing I ever gave back is you took Shelley Johnson, who was my DP at the time for The Others and The Shining and some of the other things that he did with you. Other than that, you know, all the contributions were, you know, my direction. So I was very blessed to have you in my life. And we still can continue to be friends and talk, you know, just shit, you know, about life. And Mick, to you, pal, buddy, comrade, and a collaborator. Thank you for everything. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tommy. Thank you so much.
Did I miss Joe and Axel's toast?
You did.
Yeah.
Dang. But we've arrived at the portion, at the conversational portion of our pretend dinner. So you'll
all we've got Mr. Malone here.
Oh, that's right. I'm so sorry.
Bill, make a toast yet?
Not yet.
Yes.
Bill. Bill's got a hat on. Robbie the robot.
You know, I know when I die, that'll be my thing. Guy who owned Robbie the robot dies.
No, it'll be guy who sold Robbie.
There you go. So, Mick, they gave you the Lifetime Achievement Award. Is that correct?
It's the Master of Horror Award.
Yeah, but I heard you got some sort of Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah, right? Yesterday, actually, from Grimfest.
That's the not dead yet.
Yeah, the not award. Dead.
What the fuck's up with that?
Award. You feel like you're at your own funeral service.
Congratulations on that one, too.
That's why I'm a funereal tonight. But, Mick Garris is not dead, and he's got a lot to do yet. So I just want to point that out. I first met Mick on Star Wars, because I was working for a company called Don Post Studios. And we arranged the first toy license ever on Star Wars. And I think we got the license for like $1,000 or something. Wow. But anyway, we had to go down and meet all the people. And one of the places I went was a little dentist's office, which was where Mick was as the publicist. And we started chatting. And I think you invited me over to a Halloween party.
I did.
Over at your apartment, and we just got along famously. And over the years, I've seen Mick, in a lot of different situations, and he's always just been a really good guy. And one of the things I wanted to mention is he's really been great as far as film history goes. He's been a great historian in terms of preserving a lot of stuff, with the podcast that he's done and stuff he's done with. The conversations with different people that you've recorded. And I think that's really an important thing. And of course, the whole Masters of Horror thing, as some others have mentioned here, was a wonderful event and a rare one, as we all know, in television for the director to actually get to do whatever he wanted to do. And some of us went overboard, probably myself included.
My goodness, you did. Yeah.
But it was just a great fun, and it couldn't have been a better situation. And it's really all due to you, because you were so gracious to everyone and you gave everyone your time. And I remember even on the set when I was shooting mine, I think I was in desperate need for a scene. And I said, Mick, can you write something really quick? And he got in there. And I think within about 15 minutes, he came up with this scene that I needed and stuff. So it was great. And he's just been a great friend all these years. And, I really want to appreciate your friendship and all the kind things you've done over the years. And I toast to you. You're a good man.
Oh, thanks. And you too, Bill. Thank you so much. Cheers.
I'll drink to that.
Ernest, you'll drink to anything.
You are judged by the quality of your friends, and look at these people we have arranged here.
It's amazing seeing all you guys and ladies all up here. It's great seeing all your faces. I've been missing our dinners.
Yeah, me too. I mean, Mike, I met you after we did our last dinner, or you would have been on the list when when the world heals. We'll be
if
doing
there are
it.
Any restaurants still open.
Yes. Our last one was a tribute to our fallen friend Toby Hooper, and I just want to salute him and Wes and
here's to Toby.
Gordon Toby. And to Larry.
Yeah, Toby
and Wes.
To our fallen friends.
Yeah. And and Stu, man. I always used to love running into Stuart Gordon.
Stuart Gordon.
And his wife at the
Larry
at the
Cohen.
Market in
Encino. Larry Cohen. Yeah, Larry Cohen.
Larry Cohen, man.
Wes Craven, Toby, yeah.
I still have a recording that Larry called my phone and left a message. It was right after New Year's, and it was not long before he passed away. It was right before I was going to leave to go someplace. And I had dinner, Rose and I had dinner with Larry and his wife right around that time. And I was shocked when he passed away.
Well, Bill and I have a story.
Yeah, Mick, you want to tell that story? Because it's just an amazing story.
It's astonishing. We called and made arrangements to see Larry at his home. And we knew that there wasn't a whole lot of time left, but he had a great sense of humor, very funny. So we go to the door. Bill and I were led by his daughter upstairs to his bedroom. And so he's lying on his side like this, going, we walk in and he goes, goodbye. Goodbye. And he was fucking with us. So that is so Larry. And he passed away the very next day.
Oh, man.
So what a story to always be able to bring up from your heart. You know, that was Larry Cohen, and Bill and I were lucky enough to experience, you know, probably the last great practical joke of Larry Cohen.
Yeah.
I wish I had a picture of our expressions when he did that. Cause I'm sure we looked at each other and I'm sure we went, what the
I can imagine what that was like. Wow. I mean, I still have pictures of, you know, Larry, we had dinner with, but you know, Toby used to come by our house, and I have pictures of a 4th of July celebration in my backyard, Larry Cohen and Scott Wilson.
Wow.
And they're both gone. And Amanda Plummer hanging out with Toby. And it was, you know, we became really, really, really tight, you know, and hanging out a lot. And when he went, man, it blew me away.
It was a total shock. And he was the sweetest teddy bear of a guy. And we'll always have, not just their movies, but we'll always have memories of those dinners where we were able to get together with everyone from West to well, George never came to one of the dinners, but and with Larry Cohen and Stuart Gordon and Toby. I mean, Toby came to every single one. It was kind of a highlight for him to surround himself with all of his friends. He was such a teddy bear.
Toby is one of my favorite things in a movie I made called Coming to America, which is, there's a party at John Amos's house, Mr. McDowell's house.
I know that movie.
And the way the sequence begins is it starts on a copy of a famous Monet painting, but altered to be McDowell's. But the camera pulls back and shows the people at the party. And there's Toby in the center of the frame talking to someone. And somebody says off screen, "Hey, Toby." And Toby goes and walks out of the picture. One of my favorite things in the movie. I don't think it made a difference to anyone, but
it does.
I enjoy it.
You know what was heavy about when we used to have the Masters dinners at Hamburger Hamlet?
Right.
And the one on Sunset.
Yeah. And the greeter was the ex Mrs. Miles Davis.
Sure. Yeah. She was there for many years.
She was on the album cover of Someday My Prince Will Come. When I was a teenager and I had that album, I fell in love with her. and then to finally meet her, and there's a really great documentary out called Birth of the Cool, which gets into Miles's life, and it really gets heavily into the relationship between him and Iris.
Really?
He was one of the great loves of his life. It was it's just that, you know, when he started getting into drugs and everything, and she was a dancer, she was, you know, going to appear on Broadway in West Side Story, and he didn't want his wife to be going off doing, you know, acting, you know, or doing dancing, you know, he wanted her to stay at home. And that kind of like was the start of their fall down. But if you ever see that documentary, it's really quite touching, you know, when she talks about their relationship.
This has nothing to do with horror, although it is horrible. Hamburger Hamlet started on this on Sunset Plaza by two people, a husband and wife, who were actors. And it used to say Hamburger Hamlet service in the Southern style. And all the help at Hamburger Hamlet, all the waiters, everybody, waitresses, were Black.
We're Black.
And in 1965, when I was 15, I was actually, it was the summer of 65, so I turned 16 then. Yeah, 66. So it's 1966. I don't know when the fuck it was. I'm old. In any case, it was 65 or 66. But I went into Hamburger Hamlet in Westwood Village and applied for a job. And the place was owned by Harry and Marilyn Lewis. And Harry Lewis happened to be there. And he said, why you want to work here? I said, well, it's near my parents' house and, you know, I need a job. And he said, well, son, we only hire, I think he said colored. We only hire colored help. And I said, well, I'm going to the ACLU and sue your ass. So he said, all right, never mind. You can work. So there's Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and me. I am the first white busboy at Hamburger Hamlet.
You broke the
color line. And there were a lot of ladies who worked at Hamburger Hamlet all over the place. And as the Hamlets closed, you know, they would end up always on the Doheny one. And so I knew all those women for many, many years. And they all took ownership. You know, it was like, here's John. He's successful because of us.
And they were right.
Yeah.
So one thing I just realized is that everyone here has been a guest on the podcast, except for Axel. And we're waiting for your next movie. And then you can complete the circle. And
that would be great. Yeah, that would be awesome, Mick.
Definitely.
It'll happen.
Definitely.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be in the editing room of her movie for about 5 minutes, and it really looked good.
Really? Can't wait.
Which one?
I have a movie coming out next year that I shot before the pandemic.
Called?
It's called The Manor.
Like house, like a manor.
Yeah, yeah. And it used to have a different title and it was changed. It hasn't been announced yet, so I'm not supposed to talk about it, I guess. But yes, it's coming out next year.
It's not your fault. We talked about it. Not your fault.
And Mick and Bill both have a cameo in it.
That's right. And it stars Barbara Hershey, who was my star in Riding the Bullet.
Yeah. Well, Joe and I are very offended, Axel.
Why?
That we're not
in it?
Yeah. It's okay. We were playing the not dead yet people.
Yeah, exactly. Old folks. Landon, any guidance you want to give us here?
Absolutely. One quick thing from the chat that's been going on that for all the viewing audience, people would very much like to see more of Joe's cat.
He's very camera shy.
Understood. Yes, obviously we're calling this the dinner with the Masters of Horror, and you've all alluded to the dinners and how they became this sort of fabled sort of piece of what's now modern a genre fan history amongst you. Like, how can you detail how did the dinners come about? Why did they continue? What did each of you get out of them or having heard about them? Kind of talk a little bit about how this communal aspect of your friendship.
That's all Mick. I mean, this stuff wouldn't have happened without Mick.
Well, yeah. It was grounded in, you know, we would see each other at Directors Guild meetings or film festivals around the world or different places. And always it would be, wouldn't it be great if we all got together and had dinner sometime? And
There's something more. The genre directors are rather isolated within the academy. And you gave specifically genre directors a home. And that was what I thought was one of the things so great about it. Sorry.
And that's true. And NFL and directors in general don't really get to see each other much because they're working.
Solitary job.
Well, I remember Mick was in my living room when we were talking, and I said, you know, we don't know any other director. Probably Mick did, but I didn't know any other directors because I had no opportunity to meet with them because, you know, you're working. And so Mick and I were talking about, said we should have some kind of a dinner. And then Mick went off and made the thing happen. What's great is Mick then had the idea of let's make this into a TV show, which is something I would have never thought of in a million years. But
first dinner was really wonderful. I mean, I've forgotten who, tell me who was there. There was Toby Hooper and Joe and Bill Malone and
Guillermo del Toro.
Guillermo
and John Carpenter and Stuart Gordon, Bob Burns.
Larry Cohen.
Yeah, there were 12 of us.
But it was a very raucous and very funny group. And I remember we were at some restaurant in the Valley. And a very good one, Mick. But I remember it wasn't the Smokehouse.
It wasn't?
No, the first one was in Sherman Oaks. It was the French place.
Jean or Bijot or something.
Yeah, the Petite Bistro, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The one in Lancashire.
Yeah.
There was another table that was having a birthday party. And they were singing Happy Birthday, and Guillermo del Toro stood up with his glass, and he said, Happy Birthday from the Masters of Horror. He actually coined the name, didn't he? I mean, that was, we weren't the Masters of Horror until he said so.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess Mike Mendez had made a documentary that was running around that time called Masters of Horror. And so I guess it was in the collective unconscious, and Guillermo decided to jokingly call us that. You know, nobody was ever serious about us being the Masters of Horror until we turned it into a TV show.
Until you made money off it, Mick.
Not that much money.
I'm not living in Beverly Hills. You are.
The show, huh?
Ernest said it, but it's quite true, which is having produced a lot of television and directed entirely too much television, the reality is doing that show because of Mick, and not his partners, who were brick, was a pleasure. And it was basically, you have $500,000, and how many days?
It was 2 million and 10 days.
Yeah.
Like 500. You had 2 million, really? $2 million?
Yeah. And 10 days.
And final cut.
Dollars?
And final cut.
And final cut, which is more important than either of them.
And they told me I spent more than anybody else of $2.5 million.
I wasn't going to say anything.
New master. In any case, it was a unique situation. And I remember I was shooting in the woods somewhere outside Vancouver, and we're laying in fog, which we ended up having not to do at a certain point because so much fog came in. And we're shooting out there, and John Carpenter shows up. And I think he showed up just to give me shit. 45 minutes. He's like standing there commenting. Finally, I said to my producer, oh, Mick.
Pick this guy off my set.
Can we lose Mr. Halloween, please? But it was Ernest said it, a totally unique situation to be able just to make anything and be left alone, essentially. It was fun.
Hey, listen, when Mick said to me, okay, when your cut comes out, we will give you our notes. You can listen to them, read them, or not. I have never, ever had that same situation. In
well, know? Not only that, but as the producer and showrunner, I wrote the script that you directed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you brought in another writer to do revisions, which I encouraged all the way through. And that's not something that is normally the case when you're working on a TV series. The showrunner is very protective of that work. But the point had to be made that I meant it when I was giving everybody final cut and complete creative control.
Yeah. It was a perfect experience. I can't say that about too many other things.
Perfect. Well,
you know, Mick, I have to thank you for talking me into the episode that I wound up directing, because actually there was another episode which I wanted to direct, and I didn't really want to direct the one that you handed me, because I felt, knowing myself, I can watch paint dry, you know, if it's on film, and I was afraid I was going to make something that would be very sedentary, shall we say. And but, you know, when I got the script, it really turned out really well. I was very happy with it. It was really a blessed event because, you know, first of all, you know, you were so good about making everything, you know, as everyone else said, just really right, you know. And then also I felt blessed because I've never been on a film where actually everything worked out exactly as I needed. You know, yeah. I showed up, I was one set. I was supposed to shoot outside, and I said, you know, to really have the look I want, it's got to be overcast and kind of misty. I get there, it's overcast and misty. Then the other scene I had to do was like out by a lake, and I said, I want to use a red filter. I want to shoot it in black and white, which thank you again for letting me actually film with black and white film. And then I said, I need, with the red filter, I need blue skies with puffy clouds. I get there. Blue skies, puffy clouds. And the minute I yelled cut for the last shot, clouds roll in and it like looks like shit. So
you're welcome. That we went to a lot of trouble to control the weather. It's a
direct line to God.
Who did you have to sacrifice for that? Did you have to sacrifice somebody for that?
Six virgins.
Well,
one thing I would like to say though is how exciting it was to go into the editing room. And there were three directors editing their shows at the same time. And to walk in to see John Landis cutting with his editor, Joe Dante, John Carpenter, Ernest Dickerson, Tom Holland, all of these people with completely different cinematic styles, which is what we encouraged. We wanted their films to reflect their personalities. We weren't trying to make a series like Tales from the Crypt that had a style of its own. We wanted each of them to be anything but that, to express. I wanted Joe Dante to make a Joe Dante movie and Tom Holland to make a Tom Holland movie. John Joe, Lance, Ernest Dickerson.
Joe made an important movie.
Yeah.
That is very relevant today.
Yeah, that is still
relevant today.
Still relevant, yes.
Yeah. A lot of good it did.
More so.
Well, it might be doing good this
year. Might be doing good now.
Yeah.
Hope so.
Yeah. But that was so exciting to work with people who, like I said before, I stand in the shadows of so many of these filmmakers that I revered as a film fan and became friends with, you know, Dario Argento and Toby and people that I never imagined I would have a relationship with. But to be able to be their enabler, you know, they'd had frustrating careers with studios and networks and things like that. And to be able to say, we don't have much time, we don't have much money, but you can do what you want. And that may be the crowning achievement of my career.
I can't get over $2 million. I had no idea.
Well, the average TV network.
I would have gone and made a feature for Fox.
The average network TV show at the time was $3 million an episode. So there you go.
And this is in Vancouver.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
So when is season 3, Mick?
Yeah. Well,
unfortunately, as I said, Mick's partners on that show were classic Hollywood bad name.
Which is why you have to really give him credit for the ability to create such a terrific show with not, you know, he had to deal with us, egomaniacs that we are, but he also had to deal with his producers, who were not exactly the most refined people in the business.
And they were my managers at the time.
Well,
but you're a schmuck. What can I say? You know,
but today, this is now probably perfect situation to have masses of horror come back.
But he doesn't own the title.
Yeah, well, I mean, I co-own it, but that's what Nightmare Cinema was intended to do.
That's what Nightmare Cinema ended up being, a sort of a new version of Masters of Horror, because after Masters of Horror, you know, these same people decided to do Masters of Science Fiction.
And without him.
Yes. And they did it. They botched it up.
Yeah, Mick left.
Well, he should.
Yeah, yeah, because he knew they were gonna fuck it up. Excuse my French, but they were gonna fuck it up.
They did with Fear Itself, you know, which was suddenly for a commercial network with censorship and all of that. And Nightmare Cinema was intended to be an hourly Masters of Horror type anthology, but from filmmakers all around the world. And so we were able to do it as a feature. And Joe and I are the token Americans in it, but we have hopes that it will launch a similar anthology show. And I hope Mike Flanagan will take part in that one so we can work together.
Speaking of Nightmare Cinema, Axel, do you know I never got paid?
For Tales of Halloween?
I've heard very different versions on that story. Sorry,
Tales of Halloween. I never got paid.
How long did you work?
But it was one guy.
He earned his $100.
Yeah. I never got $100.
You were paid what you were worth.
Landon, what's up?
Something I think I'd be remiss not to make sure we got answers from all of you for, with so many folks tuning in right now and wanting to hear the same way many of you have spoken about some of the folks in this room and some of the folks at the dinners being your heroes. You're all very much heroes to our festival audience, our festival fan base, and our viewing audience right now. Could you each talk about some of what in horror is exciting you right now, whether they're discoveries or, you know, given quarantine, rediscoveries? What really are things that our audience shouldn't miss? What kind of has your seals of approval? What really excites you?
I'll start with, you know, things like Relic and Tigers Are Not Afraid, just the diversity of voices from throughout the world and gender as well. And those things excite me, being able to go to festivals like yours and like other ones around the world and get the opportunity to see international horror at its best, films like the Spanish language La Llorona, not the studio version. There's some really important, special, wonderful filmmaking going on out there, and to be able to keep up with it at the click of a cursor is pretty exciting.
It's a pretty different world now, you know, because your festival obviously is virtual. You can't. Festivals are the one place where people can have their movies discovered, and you know, they used to get a lot of press because they were in-person events. And now, of course, they're all virtual. I was pretty impressed with Host, which is the a COVID movie, yeah.
The Korean,
by some guys, which is
not the Korean film. This is a new one, John.
No, this is a new movie that's about people who it's shot entirely on Zoom, it's in the tradition of Blair Witch Project, and a movie I'm not that enthusiastic about, but. But which I think is, my friend Dee Wallace, her daughter is in another show, which I can't remember the title of at the moment, but is another sort of scary movie thing that's done with Zoom. And I think you're going to find, much like Cloverfield was, a new attempt to try to reimagine the kind of movies that we've been watching for so long, based on our new reality.
I'm really blown away by some of the independent, low budget independent films. I've got to tell you, Mike Flanagan, Absentia blew me away.
Yes.
I bought the DVD, man. You know, because I saw, you know, when I watched that and I saw how you did, you know, it's such a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And it's really creepy, really scary. And it's all, you know, how you kept everything kind of like on the edges of the frame, you know, you only see a little bit of it. Beautifully done. And then Dr. Sleep, man, I bought the full 3-hour version of it. I bought the Blu-ray of it, man. Beautiful work. So there's a lot of great stuff coming up, and stuff like Lovecraft Country. Have you guys been seeing Lovecraft Country?
Oh yeah,
oh yeah,
that's very cool.
It's really quite beautiful stuff, and you know, I'm an African American man who grew up in high school reading Lovecraft. Lovecraft was the only writer that really scared me, but the racism really made me back up. And now seeing how people are responding to that and turning it around.
Yeah, like, he would hate
it. Del Valle's, you know, the Legend of Black Tom, how we took the horror of Red Hook and just turned it around and, you know, did a whole nother thing. Is, you know, I think horror is now being considered seriously as a genre, you know, where it wasn't before, you know. Now I think horror is now becoming genre filming, not just horror, but science fiction, you know, is a genre that now people are going to have to reckon with and deal with.
And we don't need to call it elevated. It's just the good stuff.
Yeah.
And there's always been good stuff around. The elevated is an insulting term to our genre, I think.
Has anyone watched Kingdom, the Korean period Korean show that's on Netflix?
Oh, Flanagan.
Yeah, the zombie show. Yeah, it's really cool.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really beautifully produced, gorgeous costumes, wonderful sets, and it's an intriguing story, and it's a zombie show. It totally caught me by surprise. And
it's very relevant too, with the king who claims to be, the people claim that he's not sick when he actually is sick and dead.
Well, that's crazy. Gosh. Yeah. Okay.
Dead. You know, I mean, but he's eating people, you know. I mean, it's
well, I've been seeing, you know, there was some really good,
much like Trump.
Some really good shows on Netflix, like Dark, which is a German science fiction horror show, which is really, really good. And another show that came out of the Netherlands called Ares, A-R-E-S, Ares, which is really, really good. It has a great lady as the lead. Hmm. And was, you know, the television is now taking over, because I remember all the times we had our movies where some of the stuff that first got cut was the character stuff, all the character beats, all the arcs, you know, cut it so it can fit into 2 hours. Now we can let it stretch out. Now we can really play those character beats, and television is now becoming the medium. Everybody wants to get into TV.
And the only thing we lose is the shared experience of seeing it with an audience.
And with scope, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, because, I mean,
especially for scary, for horror, horror and comedy are the two genres that require a spastic response. By that I mean, it's a convulsive, genuinely physical response. In a horror thing, if you're really scared, you go, ah, or you go, oh, you know. If it's funny, you laugh. Fear and laughter are extremely contagious. If you're in a crowd, now I've made some of the most successful comedies of all time. And let me tell you, watching Animal House alone is a very different experience than watching it in a theater of 500 people. Yeah. It's just different.
Yeah.
It's much like watching Night of the Living Dead or Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Psycho alone is an extremely different experience than watching it in a full house big.
Why do you suppose the Marx Brothers took their stuff on the stage and left spaces for where they knew the laughs were going to be?
Yeah, we're missing.
They had already they'd already performed them, and they said, "Oh, there's a big laugh here. So when we go back to the stage and shoot this scene, we'll leave a space." Well, now when you see them on TV with nobody there, there's just a space there. But when you see them in a theater, they work brilliantly because it's modulated, it's planned for the audience reaction, and without an audience reaction. My view is you really only have half a movie.
I always thought
the Academy
always had it right.
What, Axel?
Oh, I was going to say, I'm actually excited about the rise of streamers right now. I know that everybody's worried about what's going to happen with theaters, but I'm really excited to see that we have all those platforms right now that take actual risks. And you can see international shows, and you can see stuff like you just mentioned, Ernest, you mentioned the Dutch show, Marianne last year. How great was that? You know, the French show on Netflix. There's a lot of really cool, exciting things that we get to see, and miniseries and things that get to have a lot of money and play on big stage and be seen around the world at the same time. And I think that all of that, and, you know, at the same time, also having independent movies and weird little features that you would never usually get to see. And suddenly you can just see it everywhere at the same time on Netflix. And I find that very exciting. I think it means that there's a future beyond just blockbusters.
Yes. However,
but I think it helps.
The one thing you said that's false. They are not brave. They are not doing new and outrageous things. They're buying stuff from all around the world, which is wonderful, and they're co-producing things. But if you look at the Netflix movies, they're pretty solid B product.
But there's some good ones, though.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, of course,
there are, but there's no shared experience. I mean, there's so many channels and so many things, so many places for people to see that nobody can have the kind of upbringing that we did, where everybody would talk on Monday about what happened on Thriller that night or Twilight Zone or whatever. There was an understanding of what was being seen by the large audience. There's no large audience anymore. It's all bifurcated, and nobody has a particular take on what it is that's popular because we all have so many choices, which is great, but it doesn't make for consensus.
But the great thing about it, though, is that now we have to concentrate more on story. You know, it's the stories, it's, you know, the character development, you know, where the characters go up, how they are damned or not damned. I mean, that's what we get out of what we have today. And unfortunately, yeah, it would be great to have that experience where we're all in the same room together and get our jumps. But now, you know, I think horror can be more subtle. And it can get into more of what the literary classicists did. You know, I'd love to see somebody do a great M.R. James adaptation, you know, for television, you know. Because
it's one of the important things.
It kind of creeps up over the back of your head, you know.
It's one of the important things about festivals like this is that it exposes us to things we might not otherwise see and gives publicity to these films when they start getting reviewed and people sharing. But yeah, Joe is really right about even television used to be a shared experience because everybody saw it at the same time, if not in a movie theater. But Bill, you started saying something. And
I was just talking to John's comment about comedy and horror. And I always thought the Academy got it completely wrong. I mean, look, dramas should be the last ones that get the Academy Awards because, you know, you get a good script, you get good actors, and if you can't make a good movie out of it, you're an idiot. But a horror film or a comedy, those are the hardest things to make. I'd say comedy number one, because there's nothing worse than a comedy that's not funny. I mean, it's the worst, you know, and horror films can kind of skate by sometimes if they're not scary, if they've got a good mood or tone or something like that. But I think comedies don't get enough, comedy and horror don't get enough respect, you know?
Oh, they never did. They were the stepchildren. But it's interesting. I agree that horror is now it has much more respect. Comedy's still in the toilet, but horror has much more respect. And if you just look at the number of horror and science fiction things. Only action outpaces it on the street.
It's because they're cheap to make and they don't require movie stars or, you know, expensive elements. But Mike, what have you been watching? You've been kind of quiet here, and I'm fascinated because you're a bit younger than a lot of us are, and I'd love to hear what is exciting you.
Well, I agree with Axel. I think there's quite an interesting opportunity with streamers. And I think the difference is that, while I completely agree that the community experience of the theater, you know, is absent in a really tragic way right now, there's something about the direct intimacy you can have with a single viewer in isolation that's an opportunity, especially for scares. I think it's almost impossible for comedy, because I really do think comedy builds on the reactions of the people around you. It's something that everyone amplifies, but I think you can scare someone in a very interesting way when they're alone, whereas an audience can be comforting to them. And so I think that's, you look at, Mick, we've talked in the past about how the horror genre can be exercise in courage, right? That it can be just a little bit of exercise, like going to the gym for 2 hours to teach yourself how to be a little braver. I think if that's something you're doing alone, there's something special about that. And you look at, you know, Ernest is talking about independence. And I think that's something that before, if you wanted to go make an independent film, you needed celluloid, you needed a crew, you needed, you know, even in the digital, you know, when the digital explosion happened, you still needed a crew. But Rob Savage with Host proved he didn't need anything but his computer. He was isolated by what's happening in the world, and he turned that anxiety into an immediate story that he was able to.
I haven't seen it. Are there other performers in Host?
Yes, there are. But all virtually, just like this. Yeah.
Rob was not alone. He needed the collaboration of all those other people.
Very fair point. Yes, of course. I think the interesting thing about it, though, is that all he needed to create the opportunity, much in the way, you know, Mick, you create opportunities for collaborators that way, was just a computer. He didn't need a crew behind him to put it all together. And he made the film, and then within weeks, it was instantly available to a number of other people in the world that were having the same isolated experience that he was having. Hit him right in the heart.
I'll tell you a story. I was at, my wife, I should say, Deborah, was a juror at the Cannes Film Festival. I was not. And Costa Gavras, who's probably my closest friend, his wife, Michelle Gavras, who's a big French producer, she was also a juror and selling a movie she just made at the Cannes Film Festival. This is about 8 years, six to eight years ago. And so our wives were big involved at the Cannes Film Festival. It's a horrible thing to go to if you're not involved, you know. Mm. So we were like the wives. We were like, you know, we're not coming. But it was Deborah's birthday. So I said, okay, I'll come for 2 days. So I go to Cannes, and Costa and I are walking on the Croisette. And I said, you know, Costa, this new digital revolution is amazing, because with iPhones, with laptops, with Final Cut Pro, anyone has the tools to make a movie. This is really going to democratize the motion picture. This is an extra, and I'm going on. And Costa stops me and says, John, there has been pencil and paper for 2,000 years. And how many great books are there?
Good point. The great thing about Host is that it was made in such a minuscule manner, but the script was terrific. The performances are terrific. And it shows that.
I want to see it. Where is it?
It's on Netflix. No, it's on Shudder. Yeah.
It's on shot. Okay, yeah. I'll see.
It's a very smart, very canny use of what we're doing right now.
Of limitations.
Yes, yes. It's making the most of those limitations and making something expansive that's really tiny because its ideas are good and it's genuinely scary. And it has that cranial creep that, Mike, I think you were talking about, where you can get the creeps watching this thing because it's intimate and personal. Watching it alone, it's still very powerful and intimate. I've
been seeing some interesting stuff on Netflix. There was a little movie called Sweetheart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sweetheart?
No, I haven't seen that. Sweetheart. It's just, okay.
Basically, it's one lady. It's stuck on a desert, on an island. She was in a shipwreck, and she winds up on this little desert island by herself, and something is trying to eat her. So there's something coming out of the ocean that wants to get her. And it's there's two other people that do show up, but they don't last very long. But basically, it's her. It's a survival story against this Lovecraftian thing that comes out of the ocean, and she has to survive. And it's it was done really, really, really low budget, and really, you know, beautifully done for a little simple film.
Low budget, big ideas. You can do that.
Yeah.
Is that on Shudder?
It's on Netflix.
On Netflix. I saw it on Netflix.
Netflix. Okay.
Landon, what else?
That director is J.D. Dillard, by the way. And the film played last year at the Sundance Film Festival. He's an excellent filmmaker as
well. He did another movie called Slight, right?
Yes, he did.
Slight is a little science. It's a neighborhood science fiction piece, which is really weird. It's like how this kid kind of becomes a superhero because he's a magician, and he basically has these electromagnets inserted into his arm. And I don't want to say more about it, but it's a really, really low budget film. And just really nicely done, and a really tantalizing ending.
Is that on Netflix too?
It's on. Actually, I saw it on HBO.
Oh, okay.
It's on HBO. Yeah, you can probably get it on pay per view. Not pay per view, but on demand.
Okay.
It's called Slight. SLEIGHT.
Tommy, have you seen anything that excites you? Yeah, you.
You're the only Tommy here.
I'm just enjoying this. I just feel like the fly on Mike Pence's head now. Just listen.
Am I the only one, or when you watch
I gotta say, I mean, anytime anybody's asked me in the last...
Go ahead.
I can't hear you. Sorry.
Continue, Tom.
You there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. My internet is just freezing every.
Yes, it's doing it again.
So really, yes, it is.
It's doing it again.
I know, shit.
I love that. Remember, love that fly.
I'm here in spirit.
Just remember, if the fly on Mike Pence's head laid eggs, it would have to be taken to term.
The only thing I could think of during the whole time that fly was there was, help me!
And how much gunk does this guy have on his hair?
Well, you know, it landed on the only thing that smelled like shit.
What was it that attracted that fly in the first place? It was the only fly in the whole building.
Landon, you want to wrangle?
How about you, Tom? Is there anything that's of interest to you that's exciting you, either older or newer? Just folks, and Axel as well. If there's anything, because I know you're working with a lot of folks right now that like you really think people watching should really be invested in or interested in.
Tom, go ahead.
Oh, me or Axel?
You.
Me? Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've been listening, and the only. I haven't been able to take notes fast enough on all these shows I better try to see. I have my first novel came out, The Notch. I'm working writing Fright Night 2 because I own the dramatic rights. Thank you very much, Mike. But what's happened, this is also the 35th anniversary of Fright Night. Mm. And I think because we're all quarantined and everything, I have had an unending series of Zoom calls, podcasts, and interviews. So, I mean, in other words, I've been working my butt off, but I watch 50 or 20 minutes of something and I'm on to something else, and I can't keep up with Netflix. And I think that what John said about a lot of CG, there's a sameness to it all, John. I mean, you said that the B movie time. I don't know about that, because I think that's where Mike Flanagan is doing a lot of his work. But I mean, I've been hearing excellent things, Mike. And I've been hearing him about the new one. Is Blaylock yours?
What?
Is Blaylock Manor yours?
Bly Manor.
Yeah. Yes, it okay, is. Well, Axel directed an episode, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm hearing very good things about your work. But mainly, I've been writing and I've been reading. So, you know, the two greatest pleasures of my life were reading and watching movies. Mm. And working in both has sort of injured both of them. But, I mean, we're all fans. That's what I get out of listening to all of you. I mean, John, I go back to the Clint Eastwood movie where you were an assistant, a PA or something. You know, the one they shot in Europe.
Kelly's Heroes.
Kelly's Heroes. Yeah. I go back to all these things. Joe, I mean, I followed your career. You better know I looked at Wolfen when I was doing Fright Night, about 10 times trying to figure out the transitions. Or, you know, American Werewolf, John. You know, it's one of the good things about Masters of Horror is it also keeps you current or younger, because you're bringing in people like Flanagan, you know, and that's what you've done, Mick. And, you know, so it's just a great thing. And
Axel as well, you know, Axel, yeah, what have you been looking at, Axel?
Well, it's been 2020. I mean, I wish I could say that I've spent all the time in lockdown watching a lot of stuff, but the truth is I found it very difficult to focus on anything. And so even watching movies and TV shows was difficult. So I've rewatched a lot of stuff. My comfort movies tend to be Hammer movies and you know, older stuff. But recently, a few nights ago, I rewatched Ghost Stories by Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson. Mm-hmm. And it struck me again how great that movie is. I don't know if that's one that's been widely seen here. And I'm not sure it's streaming, but it's kind of like an anthology of ghost stories that they directed. And it's brilliant. It's really nicely put together.
A play, right?
It's, what's that?
It was originally a play on stage,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That I got to see, actually. And it was great.
The great moment on stage in Ghost Stories, I saw it in Hammersmith and on the West End, and the great moment on that on stage, they didn't do in the movie, which made me crazy. Because, you know, Andy Nyman, he's a friend of mine, I went, why didn't you do that in the movie? And he said, I thought it was theatrical. But there was a moment on stage where the night watchman goes into the place, this big area, and he has a torch, a flashlight. And so on stage, it's dark and it's lit by his flashlight. And he scans the room with it like that. He's upper stage right. And he scans the room, and on the back wall, you see the round, you know, the light, and it goes like this across the back of the room, and you just see a bunch of furniture and stuff stacked up and things like that. And then he goes back like that, and there the light, this is on stage, passes this weird kind of Japanese no mask kind of totally terrifying person thing, and you don't know what the fuck it is. You go back like this, and then quickly goes like that, and it's gone.
Wow.
And it was scary as shit. The whole audience went, ah, like that. It was a great moment in theater. It was really scary. And they did
I think there's a variation of it with like a little girl, but I think that the movie's really well put together. All three stories are pretty scary. And then Yeah, I watched Color Out of Space recently. I thought that was awesome. That's on Shudder. It was really good.
And then
I just got to watch all of Bly Manor, which was very exciting because my episode's a little bit different from the others. So I was not quite as, like, I hadn't met all the cast and everybody. So it was great to discover that. And Mike, that was awesome. And Mike, I can't wait to see your next one as well, Mike.
Have you seen A Dark Song?
What's that?
A Dark Song. Have you seen A Dark
Song?
Yes.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah.
It was amazing.
And Liam and Gavin directed 2 episodes of Bly also from Dark Song. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff.
Amazing movie.
I mean, that's what's great. That's what's been great about the streaming thing is that we're seeing some foreign stuff. We're seeing stuff from Ireland, from overseas that mainly that we wouldn't see otherwise, you know, and it's been pretty eye-opening, some of the stuff that's out there.
There's always talented people doing horror and fantasy. I mean, I remember I was shooting something in Vancouver. It wasn't Masters of Horror, but Mick was also in Vancouver. We're staying at that. What was that hotel called?
The Sutton Place.
Everybody is in Vancouver all the time.
Anyway.
I'm in Vancouver right now.
I told you.
Well, there's a movie theater across from the Sutton Place, Big Tribe, whatever it's called. And Mick said to me as we pass each other in the lobby, what were you doing up there? I don't know.
I might have been doing an episode of Once Upon a Time or something.
There you go. And he said to me, let's go see this new movie called, I'm old. What was,
Descent. The Descent.
Let's go see this new movie, The Descent, that's playing across the street. And I said, I hated the poster. And I said, really? What, you know, monsters in a cave. He said, really? Let's go see it. I said, okay. So we go see it. One, I loved it. And two, what got me weren't the monster stuff. What got me was the claustrophobia. It was a remarkable movie. And that was totally because Mick said, let's go see this movie. I also had Edgar Wright said to me one day, let's go see this movie. Oh, fuck. What's it called? You know, the...
Must be awful to get old.
It's terrible. You're so young, you don't know. But it's... What's
I'm
it called?
Older than you are.
The Woods. It's the movie...
Cabin in the Woods.
What?
Was the Cabin in the Woods?
Cabin in the Woods. Is that the one where everything is controlled?
It's manipulated.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
He said, let's go see Cabin in the Woods. And I said, Cabin in the Woods? That's a generic title. And we're watching it. And the beginning, it's okay. And then I thought, God, this is clever. I really enjoyed that movie. So there's always new discoveries in fantasy and horror. I was at a film festival in Strasbourg being given a Life Achievement Award with Ernest that they offer you one. It's a mixed blessing.
Why mixed?
Because it's wonderful to get it. And it's also like they're saying, we can put you down now.
You're done. Yeah.
Yeah, you're done. You hear people giving these speeches, and it's like attending your memorial. Anyway, I was at this festival in Strasbourg, and so is Mick. And I saw this movie. Oh, God. Oh, yes. Called The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then Killed Sasquatch.
The Bigfoot. Killed the Bigfoot. Killed
the Bigfoot. Got everything covered.
I had to go see it because of the time.
That is funny.
Really good.
How was it?
I think it's on cable now. Yeah. It's Sam Elliott giving a truly great performance. And it's
about what you expect. Yeah.
It's not what you expect. And it's about heroism and about brotherhood and it's about courage. And it's totally about things that you don't expect. It is like, who the fuck thought of this movie?
John Sayles produced it.
Really? Well, there you go. John, I'll tell you, it's a good movie. And Sam Elliott is wonderful in it.
Wow.
Well, he's beginning to wrap up because unfortunately, even virtual festivals have schedules. We can't thank you enough for all of your time. Are there any final thoughts, words about each other, words about Mick, words about the times that we're in, parting thoughts we can leave our viewing audience with from any of you?
No, Mick is embarrassed enough.
But I do want to thank you. I want to thank everybody.
I'm holding an axe.
This is the award. This is my award.
Oh, that's your. I thought it was because you're next to Axel.
No, see, he never got one. You didn't. You didn't get one of those, so you don't recommend. You don't recognize.
Joe got one.
I have.
Thank you to Mick, and I can't say anything because I have been very busy. But I can say, welcome to Halloween for real.
Oh yeah.
An idea of what's coming up for Halloween that I've been working on.
Oh.
God bless you. Oh, thank you, Mick. I'm going to leave and, take care of things here. John, Joe, Tom, all of you, Mike, Ernest, Axel, Landon, thank you very, very much. And everybody out there is watching. God bless. God bless horror.
Love all you guys.
God bless horror.
Love all you guys.
Because of Mick Garris.
And God bless Mick Garris.
Where'd you go, Mick? Now you're there. Yeah. I've made some of the most successful comedies of all time. And because of Mick Garris,
second time you said that.
But I'm telling you why. Because of Mick Garris, I'm now always referred to as a master of horror. Like, what the fuck?
Mick, thank you for everything, man.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mick. We're happy to do it.
Mick, I love all you guys.
You are the greatest, Mick Garris. And you everyone else in this room, you guys are all my idols.
You all to be mean, able
to be in conversation with you.
Oh. Mike, give us jobs. Joe and I are available.
You all nice mean guys. So much to me, truly. And, professionally and personally and all. And these friendships are things that I cherish. And they go back decades with most of you. And I couldn't be happier than to be judged by this group of friends.
Say hi to Cynthia.
Definitely. Yeah. My hat's off to you.
Thank you so much.
Rose sends her love.
Thank you so much.
Bye, Tommy. Bye. Bye,
thanks for organizing this.
Bye, John.
Bye, Mike. Bye, Ernest. Bye,
Mick. Bye,
Mick. Bye.
You're a talented filmmaker and a kind friend. We're so pleased to have been able to do this for you.
It's amazing. Thank you. Thanks, and good night, everybody. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would let the world know about it by reviewing and rating it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you have comments or questions for our Ask Mick Anything shows, send them to producer Joe at Joe Russo Tweets or to at Mick Garris PM on Instagram or Twitter or the Postmortem with Mick Garris Facebook page. This is a brand new address, so don't forget it. That's at Mick Garris PM on both Twitter and Instagram. And if you'd like to see my vintage and recent video interviews, making of documentaries, and audiobooks of some of my short stories, go to my website, mickgarrisinterviews.com.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.